Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea. Okay, happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. Welcome, everyone. Greg, tell us what topics we have on tap.
Okay, we have a great set of questions on responsibility for a child, career without aptitude, and more.
Yeah, so it seems a bit odd to call just two questions a set, but I guess that's technically true. I guess one question could even be a set.
There's the and more part.
Yeah, though. Yeah, we've got all the rep part. And next week I will be returning to doing three questions a week, so that'll be back to our usual schedule. So, folks, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that's over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
All right, what's the news for the week?
So I've just been working on personal projects and trying to get my life together and figure out what I'm doing. And Greg and I were just talking about this in the moments before the broadcast. I did a Krav Maga class with my friend Anne on Thursday, and it was awesome. It was great. It was fabulous. So I think I'm going to start doing that pretty intensely this summer, and we'll just sort of see how it goes. But I need to get out of the house. I need to go do something physical. I need to learn to subdue people with my body.
Okay. Both friends, mind and body. Gotta
yes.
Love it.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm super excited about that. That should be a fun summer activity for me.
That's great. All right. Anything else?
No, that's it. That's it. That's it.
All right. Moving on. Responsibility for a child. When is a person responsible for an unexpected and unwanted child? Sex sometimes results in an unexpected and perhaps unwanted pregnancy. What are the moral responsibilities of each party in this situation? Do a person's obligations depend on prior agreements about what would be done in such a case? Do they depend on their conception or not? If the man said that he didn't want children and used contraception yet a pregnancy occurred, does he have any moral or legal obligation to pay for an abortion, support the child, or act as a father? Does the answer change if the woman agrees to have an abortion in advance, then changes her mind? Should couples talk explicitly about these matters before sex? Boy, that's very thorough.
Yes. Yeah, so it's an easy question as to what the current state of the law is, which is basically it varies state by state. For the most part, women do in fact have the option of adoption or abortion, thankfully. Unfortunately, it's not so good for men. Basically, if there's a pregnancy, the man is very likely to be on the hook for any child produced, even if it was clearly against his will or he was deceived or whatnot, right? And that's unfair, but that is the state of the law. So, men, beware.
And
take care of yourselves.
Even if it's expected that you would have no connection, like maybe a sperm donor in a sperm bank. I've gathered that a few times there's even been guys on the hook there.
Yeah, I think it wasn't a sperm bank, but I do know there was a case in some Midwestern state where a man had donated to a lesbian couple who were friends of his, and then things went awry in that relationship. And I believe that at least there was a question about whether he would be on the hook for child support because it wasn't done through the usual sperm bank methods, even though that's what he was just a sperm donor. So yeah, the law is really, really unfair.
Okay, well, enough about what is.
And by the way, I do have a prior broadcast where I talk about why that's unfair and what the law should be and so on. So, yeah.
Okay, so setting aside the is, let's look at the ought. What about what the law should be?
Yeah, and again, this is something I have discussed at length. And if you look under the fatherhood tag, you'll find that. So I just want to review my basic views because I want to turn to the moral questions here. So no person, no man, no woman should ever be forced to become a parent against their own will and judgment. And that doesn't mean that a man should have the power to compel a woman to have an abortion. I mean, that's horrifying. That's like heaven forbid, hell no. It's her body. She gets to determine what to do with it. But that does mean that he should have the power to be nothing more than that sperm donor if he so chooses. Sex does not create an obligation to raise a child, particularly not when birth control is used. In other words, when it's clear that the goal was not to get pregnant. There's no implicit consent to fatherhood in sex. That's absurd. That's completely wrong. Particularly, again, when one is using birth control, so it's evident that one's intent is to have sex and not to produce children. Now, legally, I think what should happen is in the case of an accidental or unwanted pregnancy, the man and woman should split the cost of the abortion. That should, in a sense, be the default option, particularly, we're assuming here a couple is not married and so on. And if the woman instead decides to bring the pregnancy to term and then either adopt out the child or keep the child for herself, that's her choice and her responsibility. I don't think she has any right to force him to pay for the consequences of her own choice here, right? This is not his choice. He shouldn't have to be bearing the burden of that. She should.
Yeah, and total agree. That's very reasonable. Now, what if the woman said before sex that she'd not have an abortion, or what if birth control wasn't used?
Yeah, I mean, what if you're having sex with somebody who's explicitly pro-life and maybe even anti-abortion, or maybe you're just careless about birth control, which unfortunately lots and lots of people are. So in those kind of cases, I think particularly if abortion is explicitly off the table and there's no birth control, that's starting to look like tacit consent to pregnancy and fatherhood, right? I mean, that's starting to look like you knew that you were having sex with a fertile woman with taking no precautions. You know, this is more looking like consent to being a father.
Yeah, or having sex with the person who's explicitly pro-life. It's like, okay,
right.
Well, you're in for the consequences then.
Right. Now, the courts might rule that way, and I think they might rule that way reasonably so, but they might simply opt for a clearer, brighter line kind of test that, you know, consent to pregnancy and fatherhood must be explicit. But we also might think that marital status might matter. It might be that absent some explicit agreement to the contrary, that it's reasonable to assume that if a child is produced in the marriage, that's something that's welcome, right? But outside the marriage, particularly outside a committed relationship, that's not a reasonable assumption, and you would assume, you know, no, there's no consent here to pregnancy or fatherhood. Oh, go ahead, Greg.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to try to clarify there. So are you saying that in a free society where we treat marriages as a contractual matter, that the default contract that might emerge in such a society would have as a default expectation that, well, you're getting married and children are often the case. So unless you have some kind of prenup or other statement to the contrary, you're on the hook.
Yes.
That kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
I think there's lots and lots of optionality here in the default assumptions of the courts. Like, I don't think that there's intrinsically one right answer. No, I think there's lots of ways in which the court could slice up this chicken, basically, could divvy up this chicken. There's lots of joints. There's lots of optionality. And the particular nature of those defaults doesn't matter quite so much. What really matters in terms of respecting people's autonomy and people's rights is that those defaults are clear and they're known in advance, and that people can make explicit agreements that override them, right? Including, let's say,
exactly.
Like just in a text message, you know, like, what kind of birth control are you on? I really don't want you to get pregnant, right? Like, that might be enough to, like, make it clear your intention in having sex with this woman was not pregnancy.
And I like the analogy to the prenup, because it's like, well, yeah, you may not like that financial arrangement, and you can override it, and you probably will if you don't, because everybody knows that's what the default is.
Right.
What should people engage in sexual activity as a matter of moral?
Greg, you are going in and out so badly that I couldn't even hear what you just said.
Skype.
I know.
You're not my friend today.
Yeah.
All right. The next segment here was, what should people engaged in sexual activity do as a matter of moral principle?
Oh, that came through well enough. So morally, just as legally, no person should be forced to be a parent against their will. I think that's wrong and horrifying. And so whatever the state of the law, no woman should ever inflict fatherhood on whoever they're having sex with, right? That's wrong. That's absolutely morally unacceptable. And so if you're a woman, don't do that, for goodness sake, right? If you're a man, then you need to be careful about who you're having sex with, right? If a woman doesn't agree with that, particularly if she wouldn't have an abortion, then you are playing with fire here. And so if she says things like, I don't believe in using abortion as a form of birth control, run away. Like, put it back in your pants and run away, because that is not like that. That should be really scary to you.
Yeah, this all goes for me under the heading of, remember, sex is a full contact sport. You can get entangled with somebody legally. You can get you can catch something. You can catch pregnancy, and you can catch diseases too. It's got to be full. Sex is a full contact sport.
Yeah. So you've got to talk to the person. You've got to know them well enough. You've got to use reliable birth control. And if you're a man, the only thing that you can do is use condoms. So at least use those. But as a man, you should also be asking your partner if she's a fertile woman, right? I mean, if she's 80, right, then you don't need to worry about it. But if she's a fertile woman, like, what are you on in addition to this, right? Like, I don't want to just use condoms. Like, what is it that you are, you know, are you on the pill or do you have an IUD? Like, what, you know, what is it that you're on? And insist on that.
And a quick little conversation like that can clarify so many things.
Right.
There's also a general idea here. Take control of your life. Don't just be passive and be knocked around by fate. Actually, you know, engage things. Talk with them. Figure out what you're really up to and what you would do if something went sideways. Because stuff happens.
And I do think this is why, you know, again, whatever the state of the law, it's actually really important to know and to trust the person that you're going to be having sex with. And this is why, you know, things like one-night stands or hookup culture, you know, when you're dealing with two fertile people, it's pretty dangerous, right? Particularly if you are a man, you are risking your life and your health and your happiness and your wealth in particular by having sex with somebody without knowing them well enough to know what they would do in case of accidental pregnancy, or knowing that if they say they're on the birth control pill, they really are on the birth control pill. Because, oh my gosh, the number of people – I had a friend of mine at one point when Paul and I had our – we were discussing whether, you know, whether to have kids or not, and he really didn't want them and I was more inclined. And a friend of mine just suggested that I would, like, secretly stop taking the pill. Like, people do that stuff, right? So that's
horrifying. I really thought that was just a movie thing. Yeesh.
No, I think it really isn't. And so I can't imagine what a violation of trust that would be. And you might never even find out. So that's something that you really need to know and trust the other person. A mere casual relationship is not enough to legally imperil yourself in this way. One other thing I would mention, though, is I do think that a woman is entitled morally and legally to change her mind about whether she'd have an abortion or not once she gets pregnant. What she's not entitled to do is force the man to pay for her choice. So I think it's legitimate for her to say, look, I thought I could have an abortion. I thought that's what I wanted. But as it turns out, this is not. Like, I want this kid, or I want to adopt out this child, or whatever it is. I think it's okay to when confronted with the reality of the choice to say, I can't do this. What's not okay is making somebody else pay for that choice. Yeah.
Okay. What do you have for the take-home point then?
So morally and legally, the fundamental principle is that neither men nor women should be compelled to be parents against their will.
Excellent. All right. Cornelis asks, how much will the vasal gel, temporary male birth control, make a lot of these issues moot when men will have just as much control over their reproductive responsibilities as females? I don't know about that.
It'll make some of them moot. It'll make it less of a problem for responsible males. But when you look at actually rates of birth control use and how many pregnancies result from people simply not using any birth control at all or using it very inconsistently, it's pretty appalling, actually, I'm sorry to say. So for the responsible man, yes, this will give him a whole lot of power and power to sort of deal with the bad legal system that we have. So that's really great. But the problem legally and morally will still crop up way more often than I would certainly like to see. I just think, like, look, there might be things you dislike about your birth control options. Like, you might not like to be on the pill, or you might not like condoms. I mean, you know, there's definitely they feel different and it's, they feel not as good. I would agree with that. But nonetheless, like, man up or woman up and don't risk yourself in this way. So you can hate them all you want. That's fine. But freaking use them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Looks like it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just a live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide, and we do that with each and every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. And you can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and you also get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content. And we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that over at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Career without aptitude. Should I pursue a career that interests me even if I don't have much aptitude for it? I have a strong interest in the field of bioengineering for what it can potentially accomplish. However, in my own estimation, I have little aptitude for hard science and seriously doubt whether I can succeed academically in the areas necessary to enter the field. This self-assessment is based on my academic history, life accomplishments, and aptitude test results. Should I try to pursue this career against the odds anyway, or should I accept that I don't have the intellectual capability to do so?
So I think it's possible to say here, don't give up too soon, right? If you really want this, go try for it. Right, go take some courses, go see what happens. Really devote yourself to this for, let's say, a year and see what happens. Maybe you're underestimating yourself. Like maybe you need to stop thinking in terms of whether you have this natural talent for science. That's a fixed mindset. Maybe what you need here is a growth mindset that if you work hard, if you put in the effort, you might see some really substantial results. And so maybe you should actually try to work hard and put in the effort and see what kind of results you get. But I think that's actually not, based on what the question, how the question is worded, I think that's actually not the problem here. I think that's actually dangerous. I think that you should don't waste your time yet. Think on this a little bit more. Not because you might fail at that and waste a year, although that would be an issue, but because a career as a scientist doesn't seem to be what you really want, right? So you say, quote, I have a strong interest in the field of bioengineering for what it can potentially accomplish, close quote. So you love the idea of bioengineering. You love what it produces. You love its potential. But you don't actually love the science, meaning you don't love the doing of the science. And so what you seem to be interested in effects and not in causes here. You seem to want the effects, and you're not interested in enacting the causes yourself. So you want the coolness of this career. You want to be involved in something super high-tech and awesome. But you're not interested in the actual grind of it. And that's the issue here. That's what I see in this question.
Yeah. And also, you know, there's definitely a correlation between aptitude and enjoyment. I like the things I'm good at. And if I'm not good at it, I tend not to like it. So that's a hint to me.
Right.
Sometimes it's a hint that I use to get better at something because I need to. Like at CrossFit, if something really sucks, that's just telling me I should be doing more of that. But in my career, that's a hint that maybe it's not for me.
Right, right. Or maybe it also can be a hint you're approaching it wrong, or you don't have enough background skills, or there can be other things going on. But it's a sign of, hey, figure out what's going on here.
Yeah.
And come to some rational conclusion about what you should be doing.
But so, the grind thing, though, going for the effects, not the causes, that's a bigger deal, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think when you're thinking about a career, when you're choosing a career, you have to love the day-to-day work of it. And I have a what I call the 10-80-10 rule. So 10% of any profession is awesome, right? It's great. Anybody would love doing that, right?
That's publishing the book and getting a great review. That's the opening show on stage. It's
like that's getting stuff. The conviction, you know, with you being the prosecuting attorney.
Prosecutor winning in court. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So 10% is super awesome and great, right? And 10% is drudgery. Like, everybody would hate that, right? Filling out expense reports or whatever it is that's in your profession that really is super sucky. And so the question is, what about the rest of it? What about the 80%, the bulk of the work, right? If you love that, then that's a career that can work for you. If you don't love it, if that's also it's more like the 10% that sucks, then that's not a career you can do. Don't even try it. So when you're thinking about careers, don't be seduced by the sexy 10%.
Yeah.
Think about the 80% and whether that's what you want. What that's what you want to do.
Yeah, you definitely can't just look at the highlight reel in careers. In my case, being a software engineer type, I really love the design up front of laying out an architecture. That's great, and I love the shipping it when it's out and people are loving it. In between, there's all that work of building stuff.
Right.
And while there's definitely parts where it's just hell, if something's wrong, nobody can tell what's going wrong, and it's a slog, and that's the 10% of crap. But all the rest of that, I actually like crafting the code. I like collaborating with people and getting the architecture actually to come to life. And that's the sign that it's like, okay, I've chosen pretty well here.
Right.
It would be dangerous if that was crap work for me too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You couldn't do it for, you know, you can push yourself to do it for a certain period of time, but I know this. I mean, I have friends who were in jobs that they're, you know, they were interesting for a while as they learned them, and then they became very, very boring and very unpleasant. And you cannot, there's only so much forcing yourself to do the work that you can do. And it comes at great psychological cost. So don't invest a whole lot of time and effort and education into a career if you're not going to, you're not going to like that 80%, that bulk of the work.
Yep.
So another point here that I always think of when I think of these kinds of issues is Jimmy Wales used to say, I want to have written a book. And he would distinguish that from, I want to write a book, right? He wanted the effect. He wanted to have the book written, right? He wasn't interested in the actual process, right? Now notice,
exactly.
He's never written a book, right? And
no, he'd probably ghostwrite it.
he was clear, I mean, way back when he told this to me. Like, he was clear he was not going to write a book precisely because of this. He knew himself well enough that he knew he didn't want to engage in the process. So either love the process or go do something else.
And that goes in the same category for me as, not only would it be great to be a published author with a huge best-selling book, it'd be great to have a PhD in philosophy like you. But you know that process? That's not my cup of tea. I don't like that process.
The process is hard enough even when you really want to do it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Same for book writing and so on. So my advice to this person is perhaps find something else to do apart from the actual scientific work that interests you in the field of bioengineering. Like, if this field is really exciting to you, that's great. Capitalize on that. But maybe you should be doing marketing or event planning or technical writing or management or accounting or whatever, right? There's all kinds of things that you could do relevant to bioengineering, but not be doing the scientific
work. You could be around it.
Yeah. You can also follow it as a hobby, right? Paul, he's a radiologist in real life. But one of the things that he really likes is technology and new technology. And so he runs his blog Geek Press in part because that keeps his eye on the tech news, which he really likes. So that's another thing to do here as well. In general, beware of any time you want effects, but you're not willing or you're not enthusiastic about enacting the causes. People want mastery without the time and effort of deliberate practice. They want the closeness of an intimate relationship without investing the time required for that kind of trust and that kind of sharing, or they want that without being willing to be fully open themselves. They want to be loved by their children without working hard to be good parents. And I mean, yes, there's things in life that are drudgery. Like, I would really like clean laundry, and I would prefer not to have to enact the effect of actually, you know, putting stuff in the laundry basket and then, you know, putting it in the washer and then the dryer and folding it and so on, right? Like, there are things in life that are drudgery, right? But that should be the 10% of your life. And generally, you should be enthusiastic about not just effects, but also causes.
Nice. All right. So what's the take-home point?
So this questioner's interest in engineering and bioengineering sounds like an interest in what the field produces, not in the day-to-day process of creating that. To make a career in something, you need to love the process. So seek a career where you love the work itself.
Nice. And it doesn't look like there's any follow-up stuff, so why don't you remind listeners about your premium content on finding good prospects for romance and friendship?
So this is a 90-minute podcast that discusses how to make yourself a good prospect and how to find good prospects for romance and friendship. You can preview over 30 minutes of the podcast at philosophyinaction.com/romancecast, and then you can purchase access to the full 90-minute podcast for just $10. But if you're a regular contributor to Philosophy in Action's tip jar, it's free to you. And if you don't have access to that or you've lost the login and password or whatnot, just email me and I will send that on to you.
Excellent. All right. It's rapid fire question time. I'll put Diana on the hot seat asking questions from this long and growing queue of lighter weight questions in any old order. And since there was no prep show for these, interesting things could happen. So let's see, right off the top here. If an infant is born with an incurable disease that will kill it after weeks of suffering, should it be permissible to simply euthanize the infant?
So I have somewhat mixed feelings about this. I think that for one, adult, I'm getting an echo, Greg, sorry. Adult euthanasia should be legal. So if a person decides, I don't want to live anymore, or I don't want to live anymore under these circumstances, and their power, the person who has their power of attorney or their living will director, or whoever, whatever the legal term for that is, says, yeah, look, I see this person is now in a coma. They wouldn't want to live this way, and so I want to pull the plug. I think that should be legally permissible. In the case of infants, I think the reason to say, well, this might be permissible with suitable legal, not simply as the question says, but the reason that this might be permissible is because the parents are acting in that capacity. And so with all kinds of proper legal checks and so on, and doctor's reviews and court orders and so on, I think this might actually be a legitimate option. And it's not because, well, the infant doesn't really have rights. The infant has rights, but that because allowing a creature, particularly a human being, to suffer and suffer and suffer, knowing that it's simply going to die in a short period of time, there's nothing benevolent about that. There's nothing good. There's nothing honorable about that. That allowing a painless death is the much better thing to do in this case. So that would be the reason. It would have to be based on general principles of how euthanasia should work, not upon some idea that the infant doesn't have rights. No, the infant has rights, even if it's going to die in a few weeks.
Yeah. So the analogy to people being allowed to kill themselves makes total sense. And here the parents are basically acting much like they do in other parental issues as the proxy to make decisions.
Yep.
So, yeah. Rough one, though.
Yeah.
All right. How is weed legalization going in Colorado from your observations? Do you notice people casually smoking in public? Does the public there have an overall positive or negative view of it so far?
So,
are there deaths in the streets? Is it a big gateway drug to heroin, you know, addicts roaming the streets? You know?
From what I understand, our murder rate is way down, and there's just it's taken a big bite out of gang violence and other stuff. And obviously, we're not imprisoning people for perfectly legitimate private activities. And there's actually there's just an economic boom around it, not just the people who are selling, but the people who are growing and the people who are providing materials to the growers and so on. Generally, the gist of it in Colorado seems to be all thumbs up. There's no pressure whatsoever to revoke legalization. And I think it's been a real boon. And I think that we're going to really start seeing this happen in other states. And I just think people shouldn't be afraid of it. It's smoking pot. Like, one of the reasons why people shouldn't be afraid of it, I heard from a police officer friend of mine some years ago that all of his calls, like the middle of the night calls in the bad part of town, were all alcohol-fueled fights, domestic violence, that kind of thing. The people who were smoking pot, like they were calling the pizza guy. They were not calling the cops.
Yeah.
And
I gather people do get aggressive on alcohol, but it's pretty rare on pot.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not to say that this is perfectly without consequences. I mean, there's definitely marijuana related ER visits and so on. But at least now patients can say, yeah, look, I smoked a bunch of weed and then this happened. So, doc, you know, what's going on? And they don't have to fear, they don't have to be dishonest in their medical history.
You could get better stats that way.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's all good. I think we're going to start seeing more and more of this across the country, state by state. And I think soon it's going to be, like, I can't believe we ever had this illegal. How nuts. And I wonder what is there going to be another drug on the agenda to legalize? Marijuana is a really easy one, but there might be other things.
You think they would have learned the lesson on prohibition the first time, but okay.
One would think.
All right. Somebody comes here. Scanning the internet is shortening my attention span considerably. I feel impatient urges to move on whenever I start reading anything. Is it any advice for how to lessen the urges and retrain focus? Oh man, this is me.
Squirrel. Yeah. Yeah. I read a lot, you know, a lot of the news stuff that I read, or the opinion pieces, or the like horse training stuff that I read is stuff that comes up in my Facebook feed. And that's a really good way, but I have a kind of limited attention for that. Right. If it's going to take me more than 5 minutes to read, I'm going to go, like, I can't do this. This was just a quick break. I don't have time for that. And that's all right. So what I do in that case is I use a program called Pocket, or you can also use Read It Later. No, Read It Later was Pocket. There's another one, Instapaper.
Evernote, Instapaper, those kinds
of things. Yeah. Something where basically you archive it and say, I'm going to read this sometime when I'm, you know, I have 20 minutes. And part of the issue is making time, which I try to do periodically, but not as often as I would like. So as a result, I have this huge, huge queue. But, you know, hey, that's okay. Anyway, so I think that, for one, I think it's fine to have certain contexts in which you can only read short things. That's all right. That's fine. One should try to not have that be the only thing that you are consuming. And it might be that what you have to do is turn off the distractions when you are consuming the longer stuff, that you don't have your phone bleeping at you every time you get a like on Facebook, or you don't have, you basically put on do not disturb. So you turn off your text messages and so on. And then I think what you need to do, I've done this process. I have one of my really early podcasts was on cultivating concentration, because people say this periodically about listening to audiobooks, that they try to listen and their attention just wanders, and so they just can't possibly listen to audiobooks. And I'm like, well, this is a fixed mindset if there ever was one. You need to train yourself to do this, and this is a process that I have done myself, because the first time when I first started listening to lectures, I could go about 30 seconds before my mind would wander off to something else, and I would be, God, I'd realize, like, God damn it.
What did they just say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what you have to do if you want to train yourself is, in my case, I was rewinding the tape, right, or hit the back button on your iPod, as it would now be, and re-listen again. And you know what? It's super freaking annoying. But after about, you know, 2 hours of this, 2 hours of material, which takes, you know, like 6 hours the first time, your brain will start paying attention. And this is the same thing. I've been meditating regularly since AtlasCon, using the Headspace app, which I highly recommend. And that might actually be helpful for this person as well. It's really hard just to focus on your breathing. It's really hard just to, like, be in this moment and to not be thinking about other things, not be thinking about what you have to do or future conversations you're going to have or what you need to tell Joe or all of these other things that are going through your head. But what you can do is just notice that, say, oh, busy mind, and bring yourself back to your breathing, or, you know, your body scan or whatever else it is that you're actually doing in the meditation at that point. And that's remarkably hard to do that. But that is training in concentration, and I think that's actually really important.
I'm going to get this straight. By repeatedly doing something, you habituate it. Okay. All right. I'm
like,
down with that.
You need to practice, right? Don't take a fixed mindset about this. Don't say, well, this is just something I can't do, or this is something I'm not good at. No, you actually need to engage in deliberate effort and deliberate practice, and then you will get better at this. But you have to put in the – you have to – if you want the effect, you have to enact the cause.
Exactly. I'm
not saying
that
this person – this. Sorry, I feel like I'm like personally like giving a hard lesson to the person who submitted this question, which is not true. Like this question does not come across as fixed mindset at all, but I hear that a lot. That's why I get a little bit up in arms about it.
That's funny. I loved your story about the tapes because I had exactly the same experience, not like to the last detail. Way back in the day, kids, when we had these things called cassette tapes, there was a lot of content on them, all these lectures and things that like we would want to listen to. And I multitasked while I was driving, or even while I was later on an iPod, while riding a mountain bike or something. That's a huge block of time, and you know I'm not really using my brain for that. So I had the exact same thing going on. I would mentally blink, and I would have to rewind, and it was so irritating. But yeah, it only took a couple days of doing that, and pretty soon I was in the flow. And then I would have friends who would see me doing this. I'm like, how the hell can you track that while you're busy doing this other thing? It's like, practice.
Right.
And it was worth it because I got to layer on all of this multitasking. It was actually two toys. It was great.
Right. Now, I will say that there are times when now I find that I'm not able to concentrate. And in that case, I will generally give myself two or three tries. And at the end of that, if I'm still not focusing on what I'm doing, what I realize is I've got too much other things on my mind. My mind has things it wants to contemplate. It doesn't actually want to listen to this right now. There's just not bandwidth enough for that. And so, yeah, then I'll put that away. I might just be silent in the car. I might listen to music, something, because there are times now that I have this skill, I don't always have to exercise it. And I think that's actually important.
Oh, yeah, that is a good point. Because it's not like, I'm just forcing my subconscious to submit.
Do it or die.
Yeah, we're doing this whether you want to or not. I actually learned when it would work and when it wouldn't.
Right.
If the traffic was heavy and would require more attention, or if I'm doing the downhill on the mountain bike, hey, I really need to focus on the downhill.
Right.
So it's only, or I would activate the recording and load up. So yeah, you learn when you can be productive that way too.
Right.
Which is, that's fine. Know yourself.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's a good one. How does a person stop himself from obsessing about a difficult conversation they're planning to have with someone? You know, I'm going to tell my boss what for, or ask for that raise, confront.
Yeah. Whatever.
What are some of the signs that, this has moved beyond reasonable planning to obsessing?
Yeah, you know, personal conversations, I think, at least for me, are harder. I don't know, maybe that's just because I don't have a boss. But, yeah, this happens to me all the time. And it's really hard, and I feel like I'm spinning on something again and again, and I'm not making any progress. Well, actually, sometimes I am making progress, but it's really slow, and it's taking up way more time than it really deserves. I think I don't know. I think for one, it a lot of it just depends on the context. One of the things that I tend to do that is extremely helpful is to write things out. So even though I'm not going to hand this person a letter, if I actually get my thoughts down on paper, here's what I want to tell you, then that solidifies things in my mind enough that I say, okay, now I know what I'm going to say to the person. And if I start spinning again, I just go reread that document and my brain is like, oh yeah, this is what I'm going to say. That's all right. So that's really helpful. The problem for me when I tend to get spinning, when I tend to get obsessing, is when I don't know what I want to say, or I have really mixed feelings, or I go back and forth, and that's actually really, that's much harder. And, I think it's important to, in those kind of cases, get out of your own head and go do some things and go do some demanding activities. This is one of the benefits of doing something like Krav Maga. For me, like, if you're not paying attention, if you're not there in that moment, bad things are going to happen to you. So you really have to be there. You have to be paying attention. So immersing yourself in that kind of work, I think, is oftentimes really helpful.
Yeah. Absorptive things are pretty useful for getting a break.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's playing sax. And when you're taking a solo in jazz, you're doing that and nothing else.
Right.
CrossFit's kind of that way too. You're in the middle of that beatdown. It's really hard just to count to five, you know, whatever reps, whatever you're doing. And so,
one, two, three, three. And it's like, two, what,
was that three
four.
Or four?
And, I've done that.
And anytime you ask, is it three or four? Okay, that means it was three. All right.
Yeah.
That's funny. Okay, here's one that's a little more involved. A while ago, I asked you about the moral considerations involved in having to revive my landlord who didn't take care of her type 1 diabetes properly and had me and other people calling an ambulance for her regularly, nearly a dozen times within a year. She ate irregularly or skipped meals altogether, causing her to pass out, get very weak, or lose most of her cognitive ability. My concern was whether it was ethical to just leave her in a catatonic state, and you stated that there's, quote, duty to rescue laws, where given my relationship with my landlord, I was legally obligated to tend to her emergencies, regardless if they were honest or not. However, couldn't it be said that the landlord was literally forcing me to take care of her, violating my rights since her diabetic emergency due to Shouldn't there be a limit on to how many times or in what ways a duty to rescue law can apply? Shouldn't I be able to press charges, sue, or be rid of obligations such as being able to move out without illegally breaking the renter's contract?
So, yes, I think that by doing this repeatedly and due to her own negligence, yes, she's violating your rights. But I still think that doesn't mean that in any given instance you can simply throw up your hands and walk out the door. I think that's, at the very least, I would say that's legally dangerous for you to do. I do think that you should absolutely be able to move out without any kind of financial penalty. You should be able to withhold rent. You should be able to sue her for the cost. You know, let's say if you were late for work or whatnot, you should be able to sue her over that. There's all kinds of things.
Present her with a schedule of fees for taking care of people who put themselves into emergencies.
Right.
It's like, oh, this is more than my rent.
Right.
You really don't want to do this.
Right. Yeah, so I think that on the one hand there is legally a duty to rescue, and you don't want to put yourself in legal jeopardy over something like this. You don't want to end up in prison on manslaughter charges over something like this, right? Because you decided you had enough and you walked out the door. But that doesn't mean that legally you should be completely helpless or you have this duty to rescue over and over again. Ideally, one should wish to remove oneself from this situation, and I certainly think that one should be able to do so without financial penalty in terms of moving out without, you know, moving out, breaking your lease, basically. I think absolutely you should be able to do that. And hopefully small claims court would say so too.
Indeed. Total agree. That's a crazy situation, actually.
It's horrible. I couldn't imagine. And I know, so my trainer, Martha, is type 1 diabetic, and she works really hard to manage her diabetes, but she does have a lot of sugar lows, and it's very unpredictable despite all of her efforts. And it's you know, you have to be alert to that if you're around that person. You have to notice when she's going downhill because it's not always clear to her. And then you have to be like, no, you're sitting here, you're eating this, and you're going to sit for a half hour. You can't, you know, I know you have things you want to do, but you cannot get up and go do them. And so it's hard because the person themselves, like, they are not in their right mind when they are in the sugar low. And it's eating irregularly, obviously skipping meals, like that's a problem, but it can also be extremely difficult to manage this medical condition, even if you try to stay on top of it. So I'm on the one hand, this landlord sounds horrible, but on the other hand, I'm very sympathetic to people who have sugar lows and other kinds of type 1 diabetic problems. Cause we have all this great medical technology which enables people with type 1 diabetes to live, but the human pancreas is freaking awesome, and nothing that we have remotely measures up to that.
Indeed. Okay. Here we go. This could be a promotional spot too. Isn't it true that if the universe has always existed, then that in of itself is the strongest argument against design by God? In other words, for argument's sake, doesn't just the possibility of the universe be the metaphysically given render design arguments moot?
Yes. But there is this view sometimes that, and actually you see this in Genesis, that there was stuff around, but it was inchoate. It was unordered. And so God ordered the things and made the universe. So that view, and that was I think that's Plato's view in the Timaeus with the Demiurge. So that's a view that sometimes people will have, that it's possible for there to be basically existence without identity. And so
but
that
somehow some part of existence that is a live mind that can bring the identity.
Yes. I mean, I'm not saying it makes sense, really, particularly not in light of the axioms. But that is a view that's a fairly standard view. And so this is why the design argument and the first cause argument are actually separate, because people can hold that, no, we need both a first cause. We need something to cause existence to come into matter, or whatever it is. We need something to cause existence to come into existence. And then we also need something to order that, to design it, to give it identity, to give it regularity, to give it laws, and so on. So these are two separate arguments. Now, you had mentioned something about a little promo. So my philosophy of religion series is a bit on hold right now. I just have too many other things going on in my life with personal stuff that I need to get a hold on, and then I will resume doing those. And I'm thinking, I've actually not been happy. I'll say I've not been happy with doing those as live shows. I think I might actually resume doing them as podcasts, because that enables me to be more clear and more deliberate and careful about what I'm saying. So I have to decide what I want to do on that score. And if you, particularly those of you who are regular contributors, or those of you who have purchased access, if you have a preference one way or the other, just let me know. I would actually appreciate that feedback. Well,
I'll throw in then. I've listened to the podcast part of that series, and I thought it was you're doing a fantastic job, and I'm really enjoying them. So I want you to continue that.
Yeah.
That's just me.
Yeah. No, I'd like to finish them. That would be nice to get that done and out. But I'm not feeling up for it. I have a bunch of Hume actually to read now. And as much as I love Hume, like, I'm not in a place where I can read him and enjoy that right now. So hopefully, maybe in a month or two.
Okay. No pressure, but we love him. Okay, moving on here. Hey, did Ayn Rand have a sense of humor? Is there room for humor in objectivism?
Oh, God. Have you read The Fountainhead? Have you read The Fountainhead? Oh, my God. The party in which all the architects dress up as their favorite building, or their most famous building. That's amazing. It's hysterical. There's so much wit in that novel.
And, well, come on. Atlas Shrugged itself was one big freaking wink all the way through. It's just like, really? The second time I read it, I was like, wow, she's just dangling right here in front of my nose all the way. And having fun with it.
There's a lightness to The Fountainhead that I love, because it's got that scintillating wit about it, which I love that. I love that style much more than I love the sort of, you know, mystery novel style to Atlas Shrugged. But so Ayn Rand herself, I mean, she obviously had a sense of humor, but she didn't think that humor was particularly important in life, from what I understand, and she had these views about what's acceptable to find funny and so on. And so, yes, and there are definitely some objectivists who are downright humorless, and I mean that as a criticism. And then there's also just, there's natural variation in terms of how much value people find in humor. And I think this is related, this is a personality issue. So people who are, let's say, more high I on disc, there are people who are going to find humorous and lighthearted things, like, that's going to be fun for them in a way that if you're high C, maybe not so much. So I just think there's a lot of personality differences here that are worth paying attention to. And if you're somebody who finds more value in humor than others, that's all right. It's okay. Or if you find less value in humor, that's okay too. Just, like, don't repress it, right? Or don't artificially inflate it, but find its natural value for you.
Yeah. And I wouldn't read too much into any, it's like, okay, so if Rand wasn't big on yucking it up, then so what?
Right.
Everybody's got their own cup of tea. It's like, well, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, we are not, like, the point of objectivism as a philosophy, and of coming to understand that, is to use the basic principles to help better your life. Right? This is the value of the philosophy. The value of the philosophy is not trying to make yourself into one of the fictional characters, let alone, which, because I think it's even worse, trying to make yourself like Ayn Rand. Don't do that, please.
Yeah, that would just be goofy. Don't. No wearing a cape, striding purposefully with the cigarette holder in your hand. It's like, please.
No.
I've heard about these malfunctions.
Yeah, and they do happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also think, like, if you're somebody who doesn't find a whole lot of value in humor, you do need to become attuned to when people are using humor. And I've actually had some conflicts lately on Facebook where I was very clearly being over the top, and I felt like this should have been, and being unserious in a way, like I wasn't making some serious philosophical or moral commentary. And one of the ways that one should have known this was my use of all caps and sort of like internet lingo.
Yeah.
But it was taken
screaming
personally
about all the things.
Yeah, yeah. It was taken personally, and it was offense was taken. And I was sad about that, just because it felt like I can't make a joking comment about this and not have it be offensive to people. And that's
a rough one. And another direction on this, Tammy, for example, she doesn't do sarcasm, period. And so being able to tell when people are being sarcastic and not actually hurtful, that's a rough one. And so if you're deploying these skills, you also want to be sensitive the other direction too. It's like, well, people, you need to be attuned both directions.
Right.
Goofiness. All right. Well, see, how about something a little academic here? Could you give a brief overview of Stoicism and its good versus bad points?
God, this is actually hard. So I used to teach Stoicism when I was a grad student, and that was actually really fun. A friend of mine, objectivist philosopher, described them as the Kantians of the ancient world, and I would actually agree with that. You go read Epictetus, and you will see this horrifying commands, these duties to separate yourself from your values in life. God, I wish I had the book right here, because I would just like open it up and pick out a quote. But so poor Paul, because I was reading this, and I was preparing my course packet for class. And I'm following him around the house because he's doing various things. He's showering. He's whatever it is. Reading him quotes from Epictetus and just being like, and look at this, and look at this, and this is horrible, and this is terrible. And so on the one hand, they are ancients. And somebody like Julia Annis, who I really love for so many things, tends to, read them in this eudaimonistic school. I really think there's something fundamentally different about them. There's something that's very much a hatred of values and a hatred of emotions, and you must suppress these, and you should be indifferent to the values of this earth.
So is this going beyond just being a little zen about it?
Oh yeah, no. This is like this is apparently Epictetus, because he was a slave when his master was beating him and was twisting his arm. This is the story, right? Twisting his arm, and Epictetus says to him, "You are going to break my arm. You are going to break my arm," and then the arm breaks. Like, that's Stoicism.
That's some detachment.
Yeah. 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 Like, pathological detachment is a good way of putting it.
Speaking of alienation of values.
I would add fatalism as well in there. So just in case pathological detachment.
Oh, yeah. So life sucks and I'm going to die. So, all right. Fuck it. Yeah. All right. So speaking of alienation from values. Was Oscar Schindler an altruist?
I have a feeling that we answered this one before, because I do remember having this reaction of like, are you bleeping crazy? Pretty much. Anyway, I'll say that again. Are you bleeping crazy? Yeah, I can't even imagine regarding saving all the lives that he saved as something that you would do as a matter of self-sacrifice, that it would have been so much better for him to do the things that he did in order to actually like exploit and murder the Jews and profit off of them. Is that what's supposed to be self-interested here? Are you freaking kidding me? And it's interesting because, at least from what I understand of his story, like, this was actually the one successful thing he did as a person in his life. Like, he was somebody who had, tried and failed in business repeatedly, and even both before and after this. But this was something he was able to use his skills to do. And how many, I mean, how many thousands upon thousands of people are alive today because of him? And yeah, I just.
Yeah, you might file that under an exercise in integrity, not in sacrifice.
Well, and just, and I mean, insanity, indecency. I mean, I just, all the Germans who looked the other way, how do you think they felt after the war? How do you think that they felt after they realized what they had done? And could they actually live with that knowledge? And I mean, you have to live in such a way, in those kind of hard circumstances, you have to live in such a way that your life will be worth living at the end of it. And that's certainly what he did. And I do think that there are certainly things that one can do that are far worse than death in that case. Collaborating and so on, that are far, far worse than death. And so no, absolutely. I mean, maybe he was committed to altruism in theoretical ways, but actually what he did, was that altruistic? Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Okay. Emphatic answer there. Next up, would you agree that musical theater is the only art form that has always remained romantic? I have never heard of a realist musical or a stream of consciousness musical.
I also have to say I have such a hatred for musicals that I am not the person
hilarious.
To ask about this. The only one that I like is Sound of Music, and that's because it actually makes sense that there's music involved in this, but otherwise people generally like breaking out into song at random points. No, just
and
just
stopping
no.
The damn plot. Oh, it's so irritating.
I know.
So as a musician, I've been in the pit of a couple musicals, and it's just torture. It's insipid music, stupid lyrics, and usually it stops the action. Because of the Boise Music Week thing, it often has this big musical. And Tammy and I had just started dating, and it was like a day off from her birthday, and the family was going, and I was like, oh, this would be a nice diversion. Maybe she'd be into it. And so I went ahead and said, okay, I'll come, family. I'll be a part of this. And I brought Tammy along, and we were both just dying all the way through this long, lame, and stupid. Yeah. Sorry for people who love this stuff. I mean, it just tortured some of us.
Because if you want good music, go to opera, right?
Yeah, something.
Yeah.
Anything.
Yeah.
Although I will say, as a jazz guy, there's all sorts of show tunes that we have turned into immortal jazz classics now that are great now. But it's like, ooh, the original. Oh, no. Oh, there is our exception. You would do Sound of Music. Tammy would actually see Sweeney Todd multiple times because
I've never seen that.
Dark and messed up.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Tammy's like recommending highly over there.
Yeah. So
it's dark.
Because I hate musical theater so much, I cannot comment on whether it has always remained romantic. I don't think it's particularly laudable in the first place. So I'm just I can't do it. I can't say. I can't answer the question.
That's funny. Okay, finally, here's something a little more meaty. Why do people describe John Rawls as an individualist when his ideas seem to underlie all of modern statism?
I think because he's in contrast to very explicit Marxist collectivism. So individuals do actually matter. He's not a utilitarian. He's not a Marxist. Honestly, this is also a question I couldn't really answer very clearly because it's not, you would have to just, I don't know, do some Googling, folks, and see what you come up with here because I don't have a really clear answer to this one. So maybe we need one final question.
Well, now you're throwing me off. Let's
I know,
see.
Sorry.
I thought you were going to run longer on that.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's see.
These are like, we're going down where this is like way far down in the queue. And some of these questions are obsolete. Like there's a question here about the new CEO of Microsoft. And I'm like, yeah, that had to be years ago.
Yeah, that didn't last very long. Let's see. I'm trying to pick something light here too. Sorry.
Here's a good one. Do you prefer the original Star Trek or the Next Generation?
Oh, that says something about a person.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
All right. Answer.
TNG all the way. I, so as a kid, I I watched all the old Star Treks. And it's funny because nobody else in my family is sci-fi oriented. In fact, I endured a great deal of mockery for my love of Star Trek. And so when The Next Generation came out, that was just, oh, that was amazing. But I loved how more it was less swashbuckling and more high tech. And I think more philosophical. Well, actually, no, there's some of the old Star Trek.
Now and then, they were very thoughtful.
Yeah.
The one about personhood and Data, remember that? You know, it's like looking at what it means to be a person.
But you had some of those also in the old, like the old Star Trek too, more philosophical things. I mean, there's lots of things that were really silly about them. I really liked, there was portions of Deep Space Nine that were phenomenal, particularly the war story arc, which I haven't watched that in years and years and years. And I actually really liked Star Trek Enterprise. I was very sad that they canceled that one. Because that turned out, I thought, to be really quite good. I really hated Voyager. Because Captain Janeway was always like, you bad people are doing bad things and we're gonna blow up the ship unless you do the right thing. I mean, it was just, it was horrible. I couldn't stand it.
This is hilarious. So the original, never got into it. Too
really?
Campy, too weird. Just a little before my time. Next Generation, the first few episodes, they were imitating the original too closely. But then they turned into their own thing, and I became attached to it and watched the whole damn thing.
Yes.
Enjoyed Deep Space Nine, and Voyager was intriguing. Enterprise was intriguing. Voyager, hated.
Yep.
Janeway, I was, at one point, I just gave up. I was like, are you kidding me? This bullshit. Okay, here you are in an emergency circumstance. You're out there stranded, and you're taking freaking hallucinogenic drugs to find your spirit animal thing. I mean, come on. They were doing a peyote PC bullshit thing. And I was like, oh, it was so ridiculous. I was like, I'm done. I was out.
See,
but
Seven of Nine was so awesome. Like, that was the only thing that was worth the show for. And, like,
she was stealing the show.
I mean, yeah, like, that, and I actually really like The Doctor as well, but there were really interesting issues around that. But yeah, it was, there was Janeway.
I couldn't get past the PC bullshit.
She made me
want to
stab myself
doing
in the eye. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Did not like it. Anyway, interesting. Never originally a fan, but got attached to the Next Generation thing.
Also, I'm not a Star Wars fan at all. I mean, like, the original Star Wars movie, I haven't seen that in a while. But, like, yeah, that's fun enough. But I'm not into that universe at all. And I think I went to see the first two of the new Star Wars. And I was just like, screw this.
Kill me now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, a lot of even fans of that universe were like, kill me now.
I know.
I can't take it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But I just
all right.
Answer. Yeah.
Good answer. Okay, it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, now with more rapid-fire questions. Thanks for listening.
At least we got through a few of them. Cause we
11. We're knocking them off. Yeah, this is great. Hope you all had a good time.
Yeah, I had a fantastic time. Thanks again for accommodating me as I was doing a little bit less in the way of the prepared questions. Once again, also thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support. And I will mention, so one of my regular contributors just recently emailed me and said he's no longer he's changed jobs and he's actually now a student again, and so he can no longer contribute. And so, you know, if you wanna make up for the $20 a month that I'm not getting from him, I would be super super grateful for that. That would be really nice.
I love it.
You know, on occasion people do drop
That's
off.
That's a revenue hit there. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. On occasion people do drop off, and it would be nice if somebody else picked up the slack.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh, and did I mention you can do that at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Okay. Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just send the feedback to Diana@philosophyinaction.com. She'll share the good bits with me.
Yeah. If you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, go visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. The show features Dr. Diana Shea, and you can read her blog, Noodle Food, at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.